This is Storycatcher with Patricia Glynn. Welcome to Inspirations, stories that go deeper with people who go further. We're stepping into the world of Southern Africans who are truly exceptional. And because they're living big and asking the big questions, our conversations here are longer than those on Potpourri. Hello there and welcome to our very first Inspirations here on Storycatcher. It's quite busy this morning. As you might hear, the birds come and go. Just a word about where and how our Storycatcher shows are produced. I gather the material on the road, bring it back to my camp here at the foot of the Magaliesberg Mountains, which are in view, and do the editing and pull together here with the help of the indispensable Amy Moss. So please don't expect studio quality sound here on Storycatcher. The canvas of my safari tent might billow and creak on certain days. If I'm working late, a nightjar might join us, or even an owl, I suppose, if we're lucky. So it's very much in a camp that this material is being produced. Okay, I'm thrilled that our first guest on Inspirations is Craig Foster, South Africa's beloved son of the sea. You'll recall that he and his team won an Oscar for My Octopus Teacher, the story of his relationship, if we can call it that, with that extraordinary creature and with the other inhabitants of her kelp kingdom off the shores of Cape Town. But he has a lot more to talk about than octopuses, as you'll hear.
One of my questions was going to be, do you mind if I look down at my lips?
Craig and I crossed paths years ago in the Kalahari when he was shooting a film about the San and I was writing a book about them. I remember our encounter so well. I felt, and no doubt looked, like a damp dishcloth and was very ready to leave that place, those hot red dunes that are home to the last of South Africa's first people. I was glugging cold beers at the only hotel for miles when he loped onto the veranda, laid back and cool in every way possible. Months and months of really roughing it in the central Kalahari of Botswana had clearly recalibrated his ability to cope with what I was finding absolutely intolerable. He and his brother Damon had been shooting a film called The Great Dance with San Hunters. I've since thought, you know, that his time with them probably laid down the set of principles which guide his life to this day. Live quietly and observe keenly. Oh, and avoid interviews if at all possible.
You know, I could quite happily live on an island with no resources. I know exactly how to do that. And the other part has a, you know, huge passion to tell the story of the wild and everything going. So it's those two forces pulling each other. And sometimes I'm brave enough to do an interview like this, and other times I just go into the wild.
Well, I'll try and make it a pleasant experience for you. We settled down for our chat, and Craig quickly bagged the chair that faced the ocean, I noticed, perhaps to draw strength from it, the strength needed to face a relentless inquisitor like me.
So you're in a position now where your success is phenomenal, and bravo for that.
Thank you.
But it's made you extremely popular, and you just strike me as somebody who's retiring and private, maybe a bit shy. And I wonder if it's been extremely stressful for you to be cast onto the world stage like this. Has it?
Unbelievably stressful, yeah. So the first year was incredibly unpleasant. And the second year was pretty bad. But luckily, people start forgetting. and they don't recognize you anymore. And then it becomes easier. So no, it's extremely unpleasant. As humans, we're not designed to be in any sort of spotlight. If you look at early societies, they knew that was a bad idea. They purposely kept everyone at the same level. You know, you're doing some little film on the end of Africa and you think no one will watch it, and then suddenly you've got hundreds of millions of people. It's hard for some people to understand, but most people who get thrown into that kind of spotlight would will suffer a lot. It's a known fact.
Which made me wonder how he dealt with the Oscars and attendant brouhaha. Well, he didn't have to. Pippa Ehrlich, one of his collaborators on the film, went to Hollywood. She also took some of the pics in the book, the stunning book, which we'll be chatting about today, Sea Change. And Ross Freilich was the co-author. Craig's latest book, Amphibious Soul, which we'll get to, wasn't out when we chatted, but he's been on an international publicity tour with that. So heaven knows how he's fared with the relentless abuse that cityscapes bring to bear on his finely tuned senses. As it turns out, fame and publicity weren't the only trials Craig had faced in the couple of years prior to our meeting. A fire burnt his home to the ground, taking everything with it, including a lifetime's research and mementos from wandering the shore and swimming the deep. It even consumed the precious Oscar he'd won. But the only loss he says he mourns is some rare and irreplaceable film footage. Shortly before we met, the Cape Peninsula was battered by devastating storms and floods. People died, roads and buildings were swept away, and massive waves pounded the shore. I mean, really massive waves. But Craig had made a commitment to himself to swim in the ocean every day for 10 years. So did he go out when the sea was like a Shakespearean tempest?
Yes, absolutely. But you must remember, if you know and respect the ocean, you're going to be quite careful when there's a massive swells coming in. So we did some body surfing in a protected area, you know, swimming in protected areas. I don't take chances like I used to, but I'm there watching how the animals are reacting. It's quite fascinating and terrifying when the ocean gets that big.
You do say that the kelp lessens the blows, as it were, when you're down there. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, it definitely absorbs a lot of the impact of the big swell. But when you get a swell like it was a few weeks ago, I mean, nothing's going to stop that. It was breaking things apart.
You mentioned watching the animals. As I lay in my warm bed in these storms, I thought of animals who go up into the hills when they know a tsunami's coming. And I thought, wonder if the animals of the sea are harbingers, have a prescience about what's coming. And then I turn the page of the book, and there is a rock covered in revolting things. Sea slaters, yeah? They look like big ticks, elongated ticks. And apparently they are harbingers, yeah?
I find them very beautiful animals. It's an isopod, and they, you know, I've watched them mating, I've watched them, you know, they're young brooding in these little brood pouches, I've watched them hatching. I knew them very well as a child. And they're these very clean, beautiful invertebrates that eat enormous amounts of kelp, and they're part of the nutrient cycle. So when you get to know them, and that, you know, they've got incredible behaviors, the males help the females molt. And they split the exoskeleton in half, and then they take their jacket and then their pants off, and they help them do it, and then they mate. And this is an extraordinary behaviors. And they are amazing in that they can detect before the barometer drops or before there's any obvious sign that an enormous storm is coming. And then they depart the intertidal and they go into the higher vegetation. And they wait there for the storm to come and go, and then they come back and start feeding on the kelp. And we don't know scientifically how they're doing that. It's a mystery. I think it's got something to do with vibrations, because I noticed they react to vibrations, but certainly not proven. So what was interesting was that more than 24 hours before, I was lucky enough to be there and see this just enormous numbers. They're just everything. The rocks just go black. And this incredible migration, mini migration. And unfortunately, if there's a parking lot or something that's unnatural, then many of them die. Because there's this barrier. If there's the wild coast, they do very well. But if they don't, then they come across these big unnatural barriers. And then they can't easily migrate and they're very exposed. So then they get drowned or crushed because when the big storms come, it moves big rocks around. You just hear the sound of these rocks rolling and crunching, and it's unbelievable that the animals in the intertidal can survive. I mean, a lot of them do get damaged, killed, smothered in sand, but it's unbelievable how quickly they bounce back.
And are there others down there that you were watching and showed you that a storm was coming in some way?
The amphipods also. The isopods dominate the rocky shore, and the amphipods dominate the sandy shore, and both of them seem to have this knowledge that the storm's coming, slightly more so the isopods.
Sorry, I should have got Craig to explain the difference between them. I gather they're both part of the ocean's cleanup crew. Isopods are small species which look like woodlice and have many legs and are revolting, despite what Craig says. And the amphipods look more like tiny shrimps. They're a bit bigger and are adept at scavenging morsels left by feeding fish. They also, brace yourself, eat the poo of other fishes. You're listening to Craig Foster in conversation with Patricia Glynn on Storycatcher.
It's incredible to witness a healthy beach because literally the entire sand is boiling with these animals, the amphipods. I mean, and they aerate the sand, and it's fluffy, and it just feels like you're in this great moving mass of creatures, and it's so powerful and beautiful. And it's sad that many beaches in Cape Town, they remove the kelp because they think it smells and so on. And these are the food for these animals. And of course, these animals are the food for birds and fish and everything. So it's really not a good idea to remove.
To remove it, yeah. No,
it should be just left in place. The difference between a beach where the kelp has been taken away or left is like this magnificent, soft, fluffy, aerated, alive beach with the Mayo fauna. They are creatures that you can't see, but they're just literally thousands of them in every square meter. And there are thousands of these amphipods as well. And then you just get this beautiful aerated beach, and then there's just this hard, flat, dead zone when the kelp's taken away. It's unfortunate.
The story of the Sea Slaters' mini-migration is one of many told in Craig's and Ross Freiling's magical book, Sea Change, Primal Joy and the Art of Underwater Tracking. It's a large format, beautifully produced story of the underwater utopia that has been Craig's obsession since he was a boy. There's some text, but the majority of the book comprises photographs. They're mostly macro pictures of an underworld and its creatures that are new to all but very few of us, despite it being right on the doorstep of a large South African city. Now, this is not the tropical turquoise home of angelfish and corals. It's a midnight blue swaying forest, a kelp kingdom of weird animals whose forms and habits hold many secrets and mysteries, even miracles. We know something of the big species like sharks, stingrays, red romans, but there are creatures here that look like they come from, to use that hackneyed word, and we've got an accompaniment of a from the canvas, sci-fi movies. Truly, a sea hare that resembles, well, a hare, except it's neon green with black stripes. There's an electric purple dragon with fan-shaped hands and feet. RuPaul would love it. There are tiny eggs clustered like the delicate lace of an old lady's collar, and transparent tubes with their prey on display in their tummies. There are things that look like jelly tots and snowflakes, frilly butternuts and posies of violets. An ugly fish sucks on a rock, bug-eyed and lazy. Above him hangs a giant web of sunflower seeds. There are whips and spines and tendrils and suckers. There are textures and patterns that are utterly exquisite. And if you think Craig's famous octopus is the only dab hand at camouflage down here, think again. It seems that
what is above the water is reflected below. There's a whole planet in a single organism and stars captured in a simple shell. A jellyfish trails a comet and there's a galaxy in a pajama shark's eye. In fact, there are eyes right through the book, close-ups of eyes that stare back at you with the challenge, dare to tell me I'm not sentient and intelligent. This, then, is Craig's refuge from our loud and mechanized world. It's a sanctuary which provides what he calls pure rapture and primal joy. I've also heard him call it deep nature, but I've never been entirely sure what he means by deep nature.
I guess the best way of explaining it is, for many years I was fascinated with the wild and spent a lot of time in all sorts of African countries and in nature, in the bush, in the ocean. And I felt always that there was, you know, something missing. I couldn't get under the skin of wild nature. And then over quite a long period of time, I developed, inspired by my San teachers and a lot of the San and other indigenous people I'd worked with all over Africa, I'd kind of clicked that tracking is the golden key that opens the door to the secret life of nature, of animals, of plants. So I realized I'm going to have to really concentrate on this and do it every day for several years to even start to begin to get into what you're referring to as deep nature. And it was really difficult at first, especially in the ocean, because nobody was really tracking in the ocean. I'd develop a lot of the ideas. But after several years, I was able to suddenly feel like I could predict what these animals might be doing. And through the tracking and through following all the sign and being in that environment every day, you start to suddenly feel like you can understand what's going on. You feel more part of it. And then I started doing more tracking on land and in the intertidal and on the beach. And there are just thousands of clues everywhere as to what's been happening in the night, what's just happened. And that illuminates your whole experience so radically. And it also, if you can add the tracking with curiosity, is just thousands of things that force you to get into that world. And you notice all these little things that previously you just walked past and somehow you were almost blind to it. It's a really strange feeling. So the tracking and the observation and the curiosity open this door to deep nature. But they also somehow, because it's something we've done for so long, for me it feels like the oldest language on earth in terms of humans. You're speaking that oldest language again, and there's something happens to your neural pathways. So you sort of just breathe a sigh of relief. You feel, okay, this is what I'm designed to do. And it feels very good. It feels calm. You're just completely in awe of how these animals are interacting with each other, how they're surviving their lives, their behaviors. It's like being in some extraordinary sci-fi movie, only better.
In your tracking down in the ocean, there was no guidebook. There were no teachers there like you had in the Kalahari. There was nothing except, as you say, your own curiosity and this determination to get down there every single day. And I'm sure none of what you discovered and the relationships you built with various creatures, the octopus being one, would have been possible had you not gone down there every single day. And as you said, forced yourself, encouraged yourself to pay slow and meticulous and careful attention to what you were seeing. So I don't know what my question is around that, but it's what certainly fires.
Can I interject a little bit to say that, so you soon realize, because you think you're alone, but of course you're not in any way. That's the beauty of when you start to dip under that skin, because all your animal kin are around you, and they're the best teachers on the planet. And they've always been there from the beginning, and you've had relationships for as long as our species has been on this planet, 300,000 years for Homo sapiens, and then our whole hominid lineage goes back millions of years. So you've had millions of years of these relationships and these wild teachers. So they soon teach you a tremendous amount, not only about the tracking, but about their behaviors and everything.
And my heck, are those ways curious and curiouser. Here's one.
I saw a fascinating thing and managed to, by sheer chance, get quite a nice picture of it. It's a fish called a bluefin gurnet. And they hide in the sand and they're very camouflaged. But sometimes they come out and they spread their fins and they look like giant blue butterfly wings. Incredibly startling, beautiful animal. And what was strange about this was there was a smaller fish riding on the gurnet's back, a Cape sole, upside down, actually, riding on its back. I was like, what on earth is going on here? No idea. And then the next minute, they disappeared and the mystery was up in the air. Asked quite a few scientists, sent a few pictures, and it was just too strange. No one seemed to know. And then I always keep these things in my sort of library and in my head to try and, so I've got maybe 20 mysteries I'm trying to figure out at any one time. And I think it took about 6 years when I was I was swimming along low on the sand with my hand out. I often swim along the bottom. And suddenly a Cape sole vaulted out of the sand and stuck to the back of my hand. And I kept swimming and it just kept staying on my hand and eventually quickly flipped off and went under the sand. And in that moment, I realized what that mystery was all about. And what I think was happening was that gurnet was hunting sole in the sand. And the only safe place for that sole was on the back of the gurnet where it couldn't get it.
Isn't that lovely?
So they'd somehow developed this extraordinary behavior. And then it would travel on the back. The gurnet would just get tired, more tired, more irritated. And then I think just at the right moment where it could maybe hide under a piece of kelp or a rock, whatever, it would dive off.
Skip off.
And get away. So, but there's lots of these kind of things. And some of them, you know, take many stages to figure out. But it's great fun to solve. You're sort of like a detective in nature,
exactly,
trying to figure out these things. And it's very satisfying and interesting. And these animals are just teaching you the whole time.
Many marine biologists and other scientists are also teaching Craig the whole time. And he's quick to thank and name them. But the knowledge gain is reciprocal, in that Craig is down there among these creatures every single day of his life, which the academics aren't. In fact, he's discovered at least 5 new species as a result of his daily dives, and some have even been named after him.
You mentioned something landing on your hand, and I know this wasn't why in this case, but you do seem to have the most extraordinary calming effect on the creatures around you, or you behaving very much like them. You're like a Dr. Doolittle down there, and other people have seen this. It's not just you claiming this, that you will put out your hand and a fish will literally rest in it. Now, why do you think that is? Why you? Why do they do that with you?
So, yeah, it's a bit of a hard thing to speak about. I don't see it quite like that. I don't think I'm any different to other people. But what I do know is that animals react to things like muscle tension. So if you're going in the water every day, of course you're going to be extremely relaxed. I'm more relaxed in the water than on land because it's a gravity-free environment. And also you get to realize that if you're really slow and calm, then you don't chase animals away. You know, they don't like splashes and movements, and they're very sensitive to pressure as well, pressure waves. They can feel them along their lateral lines extremely well. They don't like certain smells. So if you're wearing deodorants and things, some of the animals won't like that. So it's probably more a case of the whole lot of physical things going on that shows that animal when it's measuring your electric signature or your amount of pressure you're putting off in the water, that it's not registering a threat. And again, they teach you how to do that. You don't kick up the sand. So you're very careful when you're finning near the sand. No fast movements. When you put your hand in the water to swim, you carefully drop it in. You don't slap it down. All this kind of thing. And then sometimes you get certain animals that are curious. Each species, there's an enormous difference in personality. So what you might be seeing is that when you go in every day, you're going to come across those animals. So you're going to have these incredible encounters. And then it might be perceived that you've got some kind of Dr. Dolittle thing, but I don't think it's so much that.
Well, I do, Craig. There are descriptions of quite extraordinary interactions between him and the ocean's animals that would have impressed even Dr. Seuss. And most of them, I must tell you, are either witnessed by others or documented on film, should you think he's making them up. A Cape clawless otter, for instance. Now remember, these are notoriously shy animals, played touchy-feely with him, even caressing his face. When Craig got out of the water, believe it or not, it called to him, and he went back for more of what he called a dance. There are, of course, animals down there which you wouldn't want to dance with.
When it comes to the big predators, and, you know, a white shark, for instance, can they smell fear?
They may be able to smell the pheromones associated with fear. Whether they'll be able to interpret that as fear, it's more likely that they will sense the muscle tension. Mm-hmm. So the very rigid muscle tension is very obvious to them that that's something that's afraid. But that's definitely not what you want to do. So you want to be seen by them as just another predator in a kind of balanced, not aggressive, not submissive, just there. On their search image, you don't register as prey because you're a strange-looking thing. You don't fit into their search image for prey, so 99.9% of the time they're going to be leaving you alone.
This is Storycatcher, and you're listening to Craig Foster in conversation with Patricia Glynn.
You make the good point in the book that from an evolutionary point of view, our paths have split a long time ago. They don't know us under the ocean. So they have no fear of us, unlike the bookies in the felt.
Yeah, I mean, you got in Africa 2 million years of people hunting, and those animals know that upright form is very dangerous. Whereas that's not the same in the ocean. Also, the predators on the land also know that. It's equivalent, say, when we're diving with a whole group of sharks, you know, sometimes quite large animals. It's equivalent to being sitting inside a huge pride of lions, right amongst them, some of them brushing up against you, and you're perfectly safe. On land, of course, that would be madness. But in the water, it's possible and safe because these animals don't see us in the same way.
When you're tracking, as you know from, as you tell us from your sand days, when you're tracking very intensely, you come to a point when you're not using your senses anymore. You are tracking with something extrasensory. It's a connection that you have with the hunted that is sublime. Now, you have to surely break the magic to go up and get a lungful of air, don't you? Aren't you severing that moment, that connection?
If you're working very slowly, say at the bottom of the ocean, and you're there holding your breath, and there's some interest from the animal, there's an interest from you, you've established some kind of safety. You slowly float up. That animal can see you at the top. You can still see it if the water's clear. So it's not broken, that okay. Whatever that is. And then you just very gently come back down again. So I don't think it is a hindrance. It'd be wonderful if you could just hold your breath forever, but that's not the case. But it's sometimes so intense that a few minutes holding your breath there feels, time gets distorted. So you're looking at these little moments of grace sometimes, and that's great. Sometimes you could gently leave the tiny little camera there so that keeps recording what's going on.
Okay.
Because you're trying to learn from these animals. They're the teachers. You're not trying to intrude into their world. So now I'm hanging back. I'm less interested in making some kind of relationship with them. I'm far more interested in just watching them go about their lives. And the development of the tracking and everything helps that. What's great about the tracking, you can tell a lot about what these animals are doing without ever seeing them. It's like a sort of hidden communication where you can infer a lot of things without even being close to them, without seeing them, because they leave all these signs, all these clues, all the breadcrumbs, and you can take all those breadcrumbs and put together this amazing story. Sometimes it's even more exciting, those little breadcrumbs and that story in your head, than seeing some incredible behavior, because it's you've had to work to put it together.
Yeah. I remember being out with some trackers in the Kalahari, and they almost felt as if they'd seen the animal because they'd seen the tracks.
It's a very good point. It actually feels like that. And it's sometimes more satisfying than seeing the animal. You're trying to, through the tracks, imagine how the feet or the arms or the suckers or the mollusk foot is touching the algae, the sand, the rock. You're trying to imagine that, and you're imagining so hard that you're seeing the picture of that animal moving. You're seeing its body. You're feeling, after a while, its body moving in a certain way. Is it playful? Is it tired? Is it whatever it is? So your imagination conjures the image of what's happening.
Mm. So what about your senses being deprived down there? I mean, you can't hear down there like we do up here. You can see down there because you've got goggles on. Mm. Sorry, you call them a mask, don't you?
Not goggles. Whatever you like.
Goggles. You've got to get the nomenclature right. You've got your mask on. And, you know, your hearing is not sharp. So, and everything's damn moving all the time.
Mm.
So does one learn to compensate for those things down there?
You start to become quite sensitive to pressure. So sometimes you can feel pressure waves in the water. Amazingly, you can hear certain fish. Certain fish, they drum on their swim bladders, and it's actually quite loud.
Hang on, they drum on their own swim bladders?
Yes, yeah, they're making a sound, quite a loud sound.
Internal?
Yes, oh, yes. Okay. So their swim bladder is like a gas-filled organ.
Mm.
And they use muscles to drum against it, like you would on a drum skin.
Mm,
and I've been able to find certain fish underwater by tracking the sound, which is quite exciting. On land, classically, the dominant sense for a tracker is sound. So you're working with the small birds and bird language, which you're probably familiar with, to know where predators are and other big animals, because they're indicating the whole time through alarm calls and so on what's going on. So in the water, it's sometimes the small fish that are acting like the birds on land. So they pulse, and you can sometimes feel the pressure wave, or you can see the pulse, and then you can notice where they are. So a lot of the certain species of clipfish will tell me where the octopus are, from how they're looking, from their body movement, from their kind of gestures. Sometimes, you know, sharks as well, if they're in a certain way of swimming, you can see they're on a scent, and then you know they're after something. So there's masses of indications what's going underwater. Animals fleeing. There's signs everywhere as to what's going on, everywhere, just thousands of them. But it takes a long time to slowly, very methodically build up that wild language.
All of which bolsters your case for diving with no suit on. You need your full skin contact with the water.
Yeah, it certainly seems to help, just the contact. I love the feeling of the water, the feeling of the kelp. But funny enough, one of the best things for tracking is, of course, having your mind quite focused and sharp and feeling good. Now, if you don't wear a wetsuit, you get a massive flood of dopamine, up to 250% more, and you get a massive flood of adrenaline and noradrenaline, up to 500%.
Hmm.
So your entire brain chemistry has changed. And that, I feel, allows you to focus and problem solve in a much better way. Of course, if you had the wetsuit, you'd be able to stay in for longer, but if you adapt yourself, you can stay in for long enough without the wetsuit. So that cold enhances your brain chemistry, and now you're trying to work out all these wonderful mysteries with this enhanced brain thanks to the cold.
And of course, cold therapy is the big thing.
But there's one thing that's quite critical, is that when you enter the water, especially if it's very cold in the middle of winter and everything, there would sometimes a tendency to kind of stiffen up and tense up.
Well, at 3 degrees, of course you're going to crave.
So what you've got to do is force yourself not to do that. Because what you don't want is to add cortisol to that mixture.
Yes.
You do not want to do that, because that has a negative effect. So you've got to actively just remain calm and not react much when that cold hits you. But of course, the body gets more and more used to it, so there's less of a reaction to it. At first, your hands get extremely numb in the feet and you can't feel them. After several years of doing that goes away, the body knows to keep the blood in the extremities. It starts to become very intelligent, I feel, with how to deal with the cold.
And you also, as you describe, you've built up your brown fat reserves, which is very different from wobbly white other reserves that I have got quite a lot of.
I've got a fair amount of that too. But what is nice is every baby is born with these brown fat heaters. That's why a small child doesn't shiver. And if you keep exposing as you grow older, your brown fat remains and can even increase. And it's an amazing way for the body to turn on the heat. But if you live inside and you always got a jacket on and you don't expose yourself to cold, those brown fat heaters, which I suspect are good for all sorts of other aspects of health, they dwindle. So from going in all these years, my brown fat is quite developed. So I can be in the water for quite a while and I feel myself getting quite cold, and suddenly I can feel this heat turning on. It's the most amazing feeling. And the body flushes with this heat, and it has a fantastic feeling. So you get more and more adapted in that way, and it's a completely natural thing. That's why we, you know, all wild people had lots of brown fat, especially living through harsh winters and whatever, and it's a wonderful survival mechanism.
When Craig started his daily dives, he committed to doing them 365 days a year for 10 years, as I mentioned. Somehow he knew instinctively that therapy lay down there, in the swaying kelp. The most ancient part of his brain would have known this, of course. Not only do we come from the sea, but we've been foraging in it for some 200,000 years, in this very ocean, this very shoreline of southern Africa, where we've lived uninterrupted for all that time. You're both very honest about what terrible states you were in, really, when you started this quest. Do you think your depression is now cured, for want of a better word, by this daily dousing?
I think that, you know, if one faces, as you go through stages in life, things can trip you up very easily. There's no silver bullet that just kind of, oh, now, you know, you're a completely transformed human being and nothing can touch you. That's not the case. So if you're quite sensitive, that is always there, but it's also an incredible teacher because it makes you very grateful to feel good. And I feel very good now. I've got a lot of energy and I feel very motivated to do a lot of things. But I think what the cold and this training does, it does make you a lot more resilient. And you've got these incredible nature tools to deal with mental health. So if I had to face something difficult again, I think it would be easier because I have these tools and nature. I've got this relationship with nature that helps it tremendously. But when I don't feel I'm immune in any way to that kind of thing.
What Craig's book conveys is an almost naive, childlike sense of curiosity and belonging. It's infectious. And by the last page, we too are left wonder-filled by the wonderful. We are awed by his awe and humbled by his deep immersion into the great web of the wild. The title of the book, Sea Change, is a reference to Shakespeare's lines in The Tempest. You remember, full fathom five thy father lies. Nothing of him doth fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. The big question is whether the book, and more importantly, given its massive international audience, the movie, My Octopus Teacher, have induced some kind of sea change in those who have read and watched them.
The treachery is that because people like me look out and the water looks the same, the surface always looks the same, we don't really understand, appreciate what is going on down there and the destruction that is happening around the world. And I wonder how much behavior change My Octopus Teacher, you think, might have brought about to people who've seen that film.
I mean, it's obviously impossible to say. The only thing that I can judge from is it's very heartening and makes the extreme difficulty that one goes through with the publicity and everything afterwards makes it worthwhile, that suffering. Because we've got thousands and thousands of these letters from people from very young to very old who somehow, despite not having been in the environment, they can somehow get this nature connection. They can almost get under that skin, which someone like me needs to actually go and do, because I maybe haven't got the imagination like they have, but they seem to get it, and there's some sort of transformation that has happened. And also what's interesting, from many different cultures. So somehow there was something in the film created by this large, amazing team. I was just part of that. And I think the magic of these animals has somehow got to them, and there has been quite a shift for some people, some sort of behavior change. Very hard to say exactly on what scale. But what I've noticed is there are a lot of groups of people around the world in different fields, cosmology, philosophy, nature connection, science, who have a similar story. And there's a slow movement I've felt where people are interested in true connection to nature. And I think fueled by climate change and all the, you know, biodiversity loss and all these things that are pretty frightening. So it's nice to feel to be a tiny part of that movement that's people are a lot cleverer than me are championing. And I've met some of them, and it's really inspiring to just be, you know, a small part of that. But it's definitely something is happening.
This is Storycatcher with Patricia Glynn, and you're listening to my conversation with Craig Foster.
So the end of the book, The Quest, is all about returning to our wild state. And you have, talking about touch, you touched on that state. And I have no idea what that feels like. Can you take me there?
I can try. I think what you may be referring to is this idea of primal joy, a wilderness rapture. And this was an idea that was first introduced to me by political philosopher Professor Louis Herman. He studied primal politics and indigenous communities and so on. What I noticed in parts of Africa, remote parts of Africa, some people who'd lived a lot of their time as younger people, almost fully wild, and then were things changed, had this incredible exuberance that would just bubble out in the form of joy and laughter for no particular reason. And then what I noticed is that if I spend long periods of time in nature, in the water, in extreme, especially extreme conditions, and especially if I was in a place with a very high level of biodiversity, many, many species of plants and animals, I noticed that my whole psyche was changing. And if I was with other people, the same thing was happening to them. So I think that our natural state, our design that we've lived for hundreds of thousands of years, in many people can bring about a natural joy, just an exuberance. Everything seems, you just feel very relaxed. Everything's fine, no worries at all. And this tremendous joy.
Ross Freilink gives a very vivid description of what it feels like when you first experience wilderness rapture. This is what he says. A feeling of radiant, billowing energy moved through my body. When it reached my head, my mind burst into flames, and I was awake for the first time in my life. There was no other way to describe it. When I opened my eyes, the world was pristine. It had just been born, and I was seeing it for the very first time. And then there's the opposite.
If I go to a place, for instance, where there's biodiversity death, like some of these cities I've been to, I feel the opposite. I feel the horror of that death and the pain of that. And it has the opposite effect. And the people seem to be far more resilient to that somehow.
Which is why I say again, how the heck did he cope with a long tour with his book, Amphibious Soul? Well, he writes on his website, Sea Change Project, that one of the ways he saved his sanity was tracking on city streets. I would love to have witnessed the reactions of people around him as he bent down to observe a greasy smudge on the pavement or a hypodermic needle.
What I'm trying to say and what I sense is that the most valuable thing that we'll ever come across is wild nature that's intact. There's nowhere on earth now where it's pristine. I've been fortunate enough to go to some places that are classified as near pristine. And the effect that that has on my mind and the people I'm with is profound. So it hits you like a rushing train that we are flitting away the most valuable thing that we will ever touch for this stuff we call money. And we're making it very difficult for our children and the coming generations because of that as well. So we're denying them the birthright that every single human had up till only 10,000 years ago. So for 98% of our time on this planet, every human had this extraordinary thing I'm talking about, but much more. They were living in these magnificent places that inspired joy at a deep, deep level and calmness and...
And a sense of your place in this whole...
Exactly. And the sense of being part of this extraordinary ecosystem and just another being in this great pantheon of beings.
Craig Foster will forever have the movie My Octopus Teacher linked to his name. But we talk today about Sea Change, which is his and Ross Freiling's pictorial ode to the sea. The book we also touched on is Amphibious Soul, which is more of a memoir, and it contains more of these fabulous stories of Craig interacting with animals and the world. Things like how he met his wife and his terrible depression and how he worked with that in the sea. Anyway, his current project is inspired by the mythical Middle Eastern queen Scheherazade and her 1001 stories. He is busy documenting 1001 species that live in the sea forest in an effort to record the massive biodiversity that has intrigued him since he was a boy. Next month, we'll be chatting about the amazing paleoanthropological finds in the valleys next door to mine. This is the cradle of humankind. So you turn over a stone here and a hominin jumps out. Vincent Carruthers has an absolutely encyclopedic knowledge of the area, so he'll give us an overview. And Dr. Kenilwe Molopiane will tell us about her experiences in the internationally famous caves around here that have yielded such extraordinary fossils. She was more or less put on the map by a Netflix movie about the dramatic and controversial events surrounding the discovery of Homo naledi. You might want to have a look at that. It's called Unknown, Cave of Bones. She's the one with the burgundy hair. It's not pink, she tells me. It's not red, it's burgundy. The October editions of Inspirations and Potpourri are my first podcasts ever. So the learning curve is steep. And I have Brett Beverly and Jane Morgan to thank for holding my hand for the climb. My very small team comprises Amy Moss, who's my audio editor, and David Lamkin, who's my copy editor. Thank you, guys. We made it. And now we have to do it all over again. Inspirations comes out on the first Wednesday of every month, and Potpourri on the third. Till next time then, goodbye.